If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. Summer vacation is over, school's back in session, and the long, hard march to Election Day is the only thing filling our lonely days. Fortunately, we are sharing this journey this week with one of our favorite guests, MTV News' Anna Marie Cox. She joins us today to talk about the renewed focus on Donald Trump's shady dealings with Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. And the Bondi story serves as a unique platform to discuss the way the media has treated both the Trump and the Clinton campaigns over the past year. Meanwhile, in case you've forgotten, America is still facing a Zika crisis, especially in the Gulf Coast states, where mosquitoes carrying the virus have established a foothold. You may also recall that we have this thing called Congress that is supposed to provide the means by which the Zika crisis is averted. Well, once again, Congress has managed to cock up their response. We'll break down the Zika week that was and the solutions that aren't coming. Finally, we return this week to our previous coverage of America's jails. It's a story that the Huffington Post provided some relentless coverage of back at the end of July. And we found at the time that over 800 people have died needlessly in jail in the year since Sandra Bland's well-publicized death. Since then, we've continued to uncover stories about the ways in which these punishments hardly fit the crime. And HuffPost reporter Ryan Riley joins us to tell some of the ones that need to be told. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Mike McAuliffe, and Ryan Riley. Here's what happened first. Good day or good evening or good morning or good weekend to whoever you are and wherever you are. Welcome once again to another edition of So That Happened, your weekly digest of all the crap we've ingested and are excreting in hopefully a sane and competent way for you. My name is Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press at the Huffington Post. This week, we have in the studio Zach Carter.
Hello.
And Arthur Delaney, still on paternity leave, learning about being the father to two children. So joining us over the phone, we have a very special guest, our good friend in Minneapolis, Anna Marie Cox is here.
Hello. How are you guys?
All things considered, okay. But I wanted to talk a little bit about what's been going on in 2016 campaign, both specifically with a specific story, and then we can talk about the way the stories have been sort of covered throughout the campaign, because there's been a lot of controversy this week about the way Clinton and Trump are covered by the media. But I just wanted to start by talking about this one story that has sort of like revived itself. Pam Bondi, who is the Florida Attorney General, it's once again become reported in the news that Pam Bondi got a lot of great favors from Donald Trump after she agreed to put the kibosh on investigating the claims made by plaintiffs in her purview in Florida pertaining to Trump University. For those of you who don't know, Trump University was a sort of multi-level marketing scam dressed up as a real estate college in which Donald Trump promised to make people rich, playing the market. He did not make them rich. He impoverished them and scammed them out of lots of money. That ended up on the desks of several attorneys general, Pam Bondi being one of them. And essentially, Donald Trump gave Pam Bondi some money to make it go away, and she complied. And then he rewarded her with a lavish fete at Mar-a-Lago Resort in Florida. Anna, you've been looking at this story anew. What do you think about this story and why it's maybe been like propped up again in the news?
Well, there's been a few different things that have popped it up in the news in the past week or so. One is Huffington Post did the report on the Mar-a-Lago fundraiser, which is a $3,000 a plate fundraiser for her at Mar-a-Lago, for which he rented the room, I guess, I don't know, who rented the estate to the GOP Republican Party for less than $5,000. He had charged his own campaign, I believe, $10,000 more than that. Like many Trump stories, contains all of the different bad things about Trump in like one single story. The other thing that's come up more recently is the Washington Post reporting that there was some funny business beyond the obvious funny business with that $25,000 donation to Bondi's campaign, which is that the Trump Foundation was the source of that money. And the Trump Foundation gave the money to Bondi's super PAC, which is called Justice for All. Okay, so the foundation has its own history of, you know, sketchiness. But pretty obviously, you're not supposed to use charities to do political donations. So someone at the Trump Foundation might have seen that that was going to be a problem. And in their tax returns, the Trump Foundation listed a different Justice for All organization, I think one based in Kansas, if I recall correctly, a nonpartisan Justice for All organization is who they said they donated the $25,000 to.
Oh boy.
Easy mistake, right? Easy, that's what they're saying. They say they told the the FEC, I guess, that it was a, you know, clerical error, and they corrected it and they paid a $2,500 fine. So many weird and bad things about this story, and it got some attention last summer. It's getting attention now. You know, what makes it especially frustrating, I think, for those of us that wish that Trump was covered in the style of he should be covered, I guess, is that this is a obvious pay-to-play story. And what does Trump hammer Hillary Clinton about? What is his biggest argument against her besides being a woman?
Her own foundation.
Right.
Exactly. Which you know, has been investigated, and there has been found no quid pro quo, you know, of any substance. And here is a case of just direct quid pro quo. The timeline is something like her office announces that they are considering joining the lawsuit against Trump University. Around that same time, she has a conversation, which they both say happened, about donating to her campaign. He sends a check, September 14th, sends a check for $25,000 to her campaign. September 17th, they announce they're not investigating, they're not going to join the lawsuit.
Yeah,
I mean, like literally, like, boom, boom, boom.
It's amazing to me because very early in the Republican, you know, the battle for the Republican nomination, people would hit Trump for doing things that look pretty corrupt, and he would just say, yeah, that's what I do. That's the system. I'm good at it. So stop bothering me about it. And he would talk about, you know, he would brag basically about his ability to buy off politicians. And I wonder if in some sense he immunized himself from these critiques by doing so, by just saying, well, yeah, I'm corrupt. That's old news. I find it kind of shocking. I have much deeper qualms with the Clinton Foundation than I think you do, Anna Marie. But I mean, I just think if your argument is corruption for the other person, you can't go around saying, oh, it's no big deal that I'm corrupt too. It just seems crazy to me.
He's better and huger at corruption. And you know, he was actually kind of winkingly allude to his expertise in navigating those dark waters at the convention itself.
And he didn't winkingly allude to it. I got that timeline a little wrong, by the way. It was all within the same month that all happened.
Right, yeah.
He didn't just winkingly acknowledge this. He said, they kiss my ass. He says, I call and they come. I mean, they're direct quotations from debates where he talks about this. And the thing is, like, this isn't just like your standard, like, sort of money for access that we're used to, and I think Americans are a little bit inured to. He broke the law, you know, several times. I mean, or at least broke regulations and had to pay fines. He had to pay one of the largest fines ever recorded in New York for the New York State Lobbying Commission. He had to pay a fine of $250,000 for improperly reporting his lobbying fees. Spread out almost $200,000 worth of donations to one city council member in New York in the, I want to say, 80s.
That's a violation of the limits on how much you're allowed to spend on, say, city council elections.
Yeah. What amazes me is he basically got he got Bondi for cheap, you know? Like, I mean, there's a part of me that wonders if equal work for equal pay here, because he also apparently donated $35,000 to Greg Abbott in Texas. So, like, you know, come on.
Equal pay for equal play.
There is a terrible gender inequity in the corruption, and I really can't stand it. Obviously, you know, one of the more interesting things about this is, of course, if you're a Clinton ally, you really want to focus on this Bondi story, mm-hmm. because you spent the past week complaining about how those of us who made a big deal about the Clinton Foundation weren't able to find any quid pro quo situations there. I mean, I kind of fully admitted in the last podcast that I kind of take Zephyr's line on the whole idea of political corruption, where just the creation of something that looks like it could be inappropriate is probably damaging to democracy. But let's leave that aside for a second, because in this case, I see why Clintonites would want to bring this up and promote this story. I also have seen this week just a massive war break out in the pundit world over whether or not the media is fairly covering Clinton at all. There's a big fight, I guess, between Paul Krugman, who wrote a piece warning that Clinton was about to get, quote, gored, not like by a wild boar, but like treated like Al Gore. It was responded to in kind by Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept, who, while making a strong aside case about the fact that Donald Trump is a unique force in this election that needs to be covered as such, sort of rejected the idea that, you know, the coverage of rejected the idea that Clinton deserves, like, to be, you know, I don't know, let off scot-free just because Trump happens to be in the election.
Just Brian because Boyler, Trump's right.
Yeah, Brian Boyler followed on top of that by saying, look, I think that the media coverage of both campaigns has become all out of whack. And I can kind of see that, because I feel like it's simultaneously true that Trump gets a lot of media coverage that perhaps another candidate wouldn't get, and that's perhaps a commodity. At the same time, that coverage has led to him receiving a lot of negative attention that has now become ingrained in the electorate. You know, I see Trump, you know, basically get praised for being able to make it through one speech without sharding himself. But at the same time,
we have no proof about that.
Yeah, and no one gives Clinton we have no proof of that. But
show
no one,
me the underwear.
Obviously, no one gives Clinton credit for being able to make it through a speech or an appearance. And in fact, there was like wall to wall coverage of the time where she coughed, which is a bit ridiculous. At the same time, I can't help but notice, but the Twitter and every social media feed in the world has become like a rolling sludgy river of Trump opprobrium. I mean, I'm having a hard time trying to figure out where the media coverage is right now in this election, or if they're even aware.
Well, you know, it's funny. I guess I could make, you know, I could sort of take a Slate style position on this, which is, in some ways, I wonder if we're seeing some of the best campaign coverage, you know, we have it in a while, because Trump's awfulness has really forced a lot of organizations to reconsider false equivalency and to reconsider the tone that they take when covering someone. Mm-hmm. I think the revolution of the Chiron in cable news is pretty welcome. I think that what Brian Stetler and Jake Tapper are doing at CNN has been pretty great. Both of them calling stuff lies, you mm-hmm. know, in a way that you don't normally see. I mean, on the other hand, there's been a lot of terrible stuff too. I think I tend to agree with, I think that is what Brian argued, which is that in some ways it's just the sheer amount of coverage of Hillary and Trump, the way that they're covered, it does lead, I think, a non-sophisticated or non-like fanatical viewer or consumer of news to think that there is some kind of weird equivalency mm-hmm. between them.
I'm almost bored by Trump's terribleness. He's just so obviously awful, and he has been so obviously awful to me for over a year that new stories that come out about showing him being corrupt and terrible, I don't find them that interesting. Whereas Clinton is a more interesting and complex figure. Sometimes she does stuff that's really great. Sometimes she does stuff that seems pretty terrible. And so stories that are about Clinton, I find myself as a reader more drawn to. And I wonder if that's not happening some in sort of the way reporters and editors select stories. Like, well, yeah, of course Trump's terrible, but you know, that's boring.
Right. I think that that's definitely true. I think that, like, in some ways, while I think that Trump's racism and bigotry and xenophobia, obviously those are hugely important and they drive his policy, sometimes they are distracting for us. You know, like, he's such an obvious thug. Mm-hmm. That's the bright and shiny argument. And also, that's easy to call out. Mm-hmm. You know, that's now a social norm, you know,
right.
Thankfully. Like, I'll defend political correctness on this front, you know, that you don't say nasty things about large groups of people, you know, because of their, you know, race or heritage or gender or whatever. Like, Americans just recognize that that's a bad thing, and journalists don't feel like they're doing any kind of putting a finger on the scale to call out a candidate that says something blatantly racist or homophobic or gender biased or whatever. So journalists are really happy to do that when Trump or one of his surrogates says something awful. That forum was just a horrifying embarrassment.
Yeah, the NBC forum the other night.
Right. It was, I mean, I got scared, you know? Like, if this man, he doesn't understand the military, clearly. He doesn't seem to have interest. And he said things, like, not beyond, like, people are paying a lot of attention to what he said about Putin, where he cited Putin's approval rating as proof that he's, like, somehow a reputable source.
Right.
A lot of reputable polls there in Russia right
now.
Yeah,
a lot of good polling. A lot of good polling. What's you know, what's the 538 rating on that polling? That's getting a lot of attention, but also he talked about, you know, getting rid of all the generals that we currently have.
Theoretically, after they submit their plan to defeat ISIS in 30 days.
You know, or is it the new general that will submit the plan? Whatever. It's not consistent. But that statement shows, like, an ignorance and contempt for, like, how the relationship between the military and the civilian commander-in-chief, like, there's a balance there, you know? Like, it's a big deal when you relieve someone command. First of all, the president can't fire somebody. They can only relieve command. And then also, those are not generally considered political appointments.
Yeah, right. Definitely.
It's sort of this thing. It's a tradition we have where, like, we tend to kind of, Congress actually oversees the promotion of generals. It's a whole balance of power thing that I don't think he understands. And also dismissing whole swaths of people from government because they disagree with you is literally a thing that Stalin did. Literally.
I think a lot of that, and yet during that forum, you know, Matt Lauer was unable to, like, challenge Trump on his claim that he had always opposed the Iraq war from the beginning, which is just not true. It is a lie.
It's something that everyone should be able to do by now because it's been so well reported that that's a lie.
But I think, you know, things like Trump University, though, it just you get to the point where, you know, it's not just that he's doing something that's corrupt and pay to play. He's doing something that's corrupt, pay to play politics with an institution which has been accused of extremely gross fraud on its own customers. It's not like just a building that went up and he cheated to get the building permits or something. He's cheating to cheat people. And I think once you have that, once you've heard a certain number of these stories, you start becoming kind of numb to, like, how horrible these things are. Like, just listening to you talk about Trump and the generals, I'm like, Jesus Christ, how could this guy be running for president? But I feel like I've had that thought in my head, like, every day for the last year.
I'll say this. I think that, like you say, Anna, the sort of Chiron revolution has been a welcome change. And people calling people out live on the air when it happens is a welcome change, too. But just to bring this back to home to Pam Bondi, I want to just point out that Pam Bondi didn't, like, emerge from a vacuum. And then that she and Donald Trump, their dealings with each other didn't just sort of, like, spring out of nowhere. Pam Bondi is a key figure in the foreclosure crisis in America. As David Dayan details in his book Chain of Title, she had the opportunity to oversee and help people who were trying to prove that the banks that were foreclosing on their homes were doing so based upon fraudulent documentation. And what Pam Bondi did instead was she fired the lawyers that were attempting to help those homeowners out. Those homeowners, by the way, sort of collectively came together and started their own mini media empire on blogs, documenting their experiences, documenting their research, and trying to help one another out. And I just have to say that if the media is really excited about the changes that have come up with Donald Trump, they ought to explore this, take this to the next level, and be more at home when stories like that are happening, because that actually happened. Pam Bondi was a fraudster long before Donald Trump entered her life and long before this campaign started. And people were really hurt by it, people who really could have used a lot of media attention because their claims were just and true, and they got screwed as a result.
Right. No, she's a garbage person. I mean, like, I didn't know when you started talking about her, like, I was curious what flavor of the 32 that she has available of garbage you were going to take from, because, you know, she's a homophobe, she's a hypocrite, she also is an NRA crusader. She once rescheduled a death penalty, carrying out, they were going to, you know, put someone to death on one of many in Florida, and she had it rescheduled so she could go to a fundraiser. You know, she was found to have deleted emails and texts in violation of government record keeping. You know, I don't even, I mean, there's a list, you know, of like all of her terribleness. I've been also like, I don't know if I'm the first person, but I've been calling her Tea Party Barbie. She is like sort of representative of like all of the awful things that sort of this latest iteration of the, you know, GOP has done.
You never thought that Chris Christie would be the preferable choice to anything. All right. Obviously, it's a mess and people are garbage. But Anna Marie, thanks for not being a garbage person.
Yeah, you guys are not garbage either, and I enjoy spending time with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much. And folks, we have a really good show coming up, so please stick around. We will be right back.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And we are back. Joining me in the studio, we have Zach Carter.
Hello, everyone.
And we are also joined by Ryan Riley.
Hey there.
So back at the end of July, Ryan, you and Dana Liebelson published a gigantic piece, massive research undertaking, really, into the nature of our jail system. And let's be clear from the outset, because I remember not being clear at the start of the last segment we did on this. We're talking about jail here. We're talking not about prison writ large. We're talking about county lockups, the place where you were detained upon arrest, between your arrest and arraignment, trial dates, that kind of thing.
Sure, yeah.
So county jails.
Yep.
And what you found was harrowing, that people tend to die there in great numbers. And in the first 72 hours, if they're kept there.
Yeah, it's very frequent.
So I remember when we finished that segment, you published a story. I remember you expressed a hope that there'd be means of following up on this. I'm sure that what you wanted to be able to follow up on is, hey, everyone read my story, and jail systems are taking it very seriously, and they're reforming all their bad practices.
Yeah.
Didn't quite work out that way, but you have heard some more rather harrowing stories about people who have ended up in stir and have suffered and died as a result.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, in this particular case, it's one that we spent a lot of time sort of researching. And what's interesting about it was, you know, last year, I think in the year after Sandra Bland's death, there was like one other major jail death that got a lot of attention, and it was involving J. Michael Mitchell, who is this 24-year-old with mental illness who died in a jail in Virginia after he had been accused of stealing about $5 in snacks from a convenience store. So he spent about like almost 4 months there until his death, and he lost all of this weight. And essentially, it was sort of an incredible story because it ended up that he had been ordered to basically go to a mental facility by a judge, but essentially somebody lost some paperwork somewhere, and basically the conclusion is basically he starved to death. A 24-year-old, it was sort of an incredible story. So about 2 months after that, it turns out there was another death at the jail. And we only actually came across this because we had submitted some public records requests. And as part of the jail project to sort of find out, you know, who else had died across the country. And Virginia has a reporting system. So those names usually aren't made public, but we were able to get them through a public records request. And one of the names that came up on this was ended up being the individual who we focused on in this story. His name is Mark Goodrum. He was 60 years old, and it ended up that he had been arrested, or not arrested, but initially charged after some neighbors in his apartment complex had complained about smelling weed. Some cops showed up at the door, and he ended up being cited for marijuana possession, pretty minor misdemeanor charge. After that, he ended up having a stroke, and he had missed some court dates, so there was a warrant out for his arrest. He ended up being kicked out of that apartment complex, was in another apartment complex that he got evicted from because he was going through all these medical problems. And when the cops showed up to help evict him from that, found the warrant out for him, locked him up, and arrested him, he didn't have his bond was set pretty low, pretty standard bond, which was $1,000, which means that you could pay 10% of that, $100, and get out. He didn't have $100. He was broke. So he ended up spending a month in there until he finally died. He had some serious medical problems, so we can't say directly that this was a case of neglect necessarily on the part of the jail. I think the bigger story here was probably what the hell was a guy doing on a pot charge locked up for a month, especially someone
who was 60 years old.
Who was 60 years old and who's had all these, medical problems. I mean, guy had a stroke. He had his one leg amputated. This wasn't a major crime lord. This was a guy who was smoking pot in his own house and ended up dying in jail.
So there are a lot of problems with that. But one that sort of jumps out at me is the routine use of these of the bond system. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about that a lot, but in other countries, this doesn't exist. The
right.
idea that if you pay somebody money, you don't have to be locked in a cage.
Right. Is
this something
that's
being...
I think it's us in the Philippines that does it. I think it's, it's very unique. It's strange.
And is this something that criminal justice reformers are looking at? That, like, why do we do this at all? I mean, why are we putting – if you have $100, why are you allowed to not go to jail
sure.
versus somebody else?
Yeah, I mean, well, the system doesn't make any sense. I don't think anyone looks at this system and says, yes, this is the best way of – I mean, the only people who think that are the people in the bail industry. If you look at this from, like, that's who's really fighting against this. And actually, the Justice Department just entered into a case that we've been following is an appeal, basically a man who was also locked up because he couldn't afford a certain amount of money. So there's a lot of interest, a lot of monetary interest in keeping the system as it exists in a lot of states going at this point. You know, we don't have this in D.C., actually. D.C. has been actually a little bit out ahead of the curve on this and sort of makes assessments based on public risk, which is really what it should ultimately
right.
be about. That
and
should really
60-year-old stroke victim who once got eyes should be considered
right.
a threat to society and need to be locked up, especially need to be locked up in a situation where, like, the only way out is for it to shake him upside down and get his last $100 off him.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, like, it's sort of crazy, right? Because, I mean, there's the other side of this too, where people actually, if you're really rich and if you, like, murder someone, like, the idea you could, if you just happen to be a loaded person who murdered someone, you can actually be out on, on bail. Like before
relatively
your
simple.
Trial, right? Even
yeah.
though you're – no matter what your public – they can set it really high. But if you have enough money, you can get there, right? But so
right.
it doesn't really have any – and there's been tons of studies. There's no science on this that says like, oh, like – or studies on this that say that, oh, you're more likely because of this bail system. Like, right? Because, I mean, in his case, right, if he put $100 up, he's losing that $100 no matter what. Like it doesn't matter mm-hmm. if he showed like –
it's a fine essentially.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Well, for not – for right. Or it's like – yeah. I mean, but – so –
before trial.
Right. If he had $1,000 and he put up $1,000, he would get that money back, right? But he has to pay this outside, you know, for-profit group a 10% fee, and then they keep that money and they put up $1,000 for him. But then that $100 is gone forever no matter what happens with his case, even if he's completely innocent, you know, found not guilty, whatever.
Sure.
Yeah, but... But, you know, he couldn't come up with that. I mean, the guy was bankrupt. So, I mean, that's what happened.
He's getting evicted.
Right, which sort of for taxpayers makes, like, is just a terrible thing, right? Because, I mean, not like, because this guy couldn't come up with $100, not because he's a public safety threat. He's literally bedridden. I mean, he's not going anywhere. But because of that, the taxpayers end up on the hook for, like, putting this guy and giving him terrible care, apparently. You know, I mean, there's been complaints every point.
Well, yeah, clearly.
Right.
Yeah.
But, like, that was an expensive – taxpayers were on the hook for that, right? Like,
yeah.
Because of that, he died.
Right. We didn't get any kind of – there was no kind of taxpayer benefits, any of this.
No, not at all.
I'm wondering if there was any kind of taxpayer benefit to another case that you cite. We can say fortunately no one died in this mm-hmm. case. But you also have a story that came out about 10 days ago about a woman named Nikki Petri, who essentially kited a $29 check and ended up in jail for 35 days for having you know, kited a tiny check.
Right.
How on earth did this happen? Because this seems to me tantamount to running a debtor's prison.
Yeah, I mean, that was like the closest, like, you know, debtor's prison is a phrase that's thrown around, you know, it's catchy, it's clicky, it's thrown around
a lot.
Well,
they used to exist in they used to be widely practiced, the idea of a debtor's prison.
Sure, in a lot of ways it does, but like this was directly basically a debtor's prison. Like,
right.
I mean, the most direct, like, oh, it's literally
it's never really clear to me how if you owe someone a debt, locking them in a cage makes them more likely to be able to pay them back.
In a lot of cases, I mean, like, this is terrible, but a lot of that works for a lot of people, right? Because if you're in jail, like, and you have family members who have any money, even if you don't have any money, they're going to give whatever kind of money they have out of their pocket to, like, get you out of that situation.
Right.
But if you have, you know, connections and, you know, there's obviously a ton of this that goes into the history and race, and that's why it's more difficult, you know, because of, you know, years and years of oppression and whatever, and the idea that, you know, African-Americans aren't as able to build up wealth as easily, that's also part of it, right? So it ends up, you know, being racially discriminatory. People end up spending a longer time in jail because they don't have the families don't have as much money as they.
But this is also on basic civil debt collection standards.
Right.
Like that's actually considered harassment if a debt collector goes after your family to try and get your family members to pay up for your debt. So this is a case where it works because the government is basically doing things that the government bans shady debt collectors from doing.
Yes. Yeah, this would be like a huge like criminal enterprise if it was anybody else other than the government doing it, right?
It's what's funny to me is that we had the opportunity to actually jail a bunch of people running a criminal enterprise, by which I mean the Wall Streeters who destroyed the economy. People like Attorney General Eric Holder cited sort of legal philosophy of collateral compensation. And he argued that if we, you know, were to like pry a bunch of banks. A bunch of bankers out of their roosts and put them on trial and throw them in jail, that it would shake the faith in the system. How come we don't have a sort of like that kind of standard for the little guy?
I mean, I think Ryan's work shows that it actually does shake the faith in the system.
Yeah, I guess that's
that when
true.
You put these guys in jail and it's exposed and people know about it, I think it does make people think that maybe the system is bad. And so you see a lot of people protesting in the streets over it.
Yeah. It's very one-sided. I anticipate that you're going to get a lot more bad news before you hear any good news. But have you heard any kind of like the impact of your story? Any good things out there?
Well, what was interesting? I mean, I heard after that story about Nikki ran. I heard from a ton of readers who were just like interested in sort of helping her out. So I mean, that was sort of, you know, heartening. But I mean, the issue is that it's not just her, right? I mean, this is an entire system.
Yeah, sure.
And
sure.
Every Thursday, if you showed up to this court, it was called a hot check court, you would find like lines of people just with these like miserable stories. There's one guy who actually just wrote a check to a gas station when he was a teenager. He's now in his mid-30s. And he still has to show up to this court over it because like they just, I mean, it was an enterprise. It was a very, very I mean, the town got a lot of money off of this. I mean, because someone bounced a check for less than $20, they could get thousands and thousands of dollars out of them over the years. Because, you know, initially it would be like $400, but then if the person didn't have that cash, it would like, and they missed a court date. Oh, great for news for us. They missed a court date. More money for us. Like, it was just, I mean, it was just insane.
It's really insane. Yeah. But continue, people out there, if you hear stories like this, please continue to share them with us. Please continue to share them with Ryan. Ryan, your email is
Ryan.Reilly, R-E-I-L-L-Y, at HuffingtonPost.com.
Yes. Please send us your stories. Thanks a lot, Ryan.
Thanks
Zach. And we will be right back. And we're back. So after repeated warnings that this would happen, mosquitoes carrying the Zika virus have made their firm beachhead in the Sunshine State. And now women who are at risk at receiving Zika-related birth defects find themselves, well, at risk. Meanwhile, Congress, which has been tasked with doing a thing, anything at all, about Zika, once again, neared the red zone and failed to score. Joining to talk about what's become something of a perennial thing to talk about is Mike McAuliffe.
Yeah. Hey. Hello there.
Hey. How's it going?
Pretty good, except that the Zika thing's a little depressing, you know?
The Zika thing is kind of depressing because on top of the fact that currently the Centers for Disease Control is in their patchwork Rob Peter to pay Paul budget action against Zika, we wait for Congress to do something of any kind. This week, of course, was a big milestone. They were supposed to get something done, but they flummoxed themselves again. Mike, tell us what happened.
Well, they left for their 7-week vacation, which, as Harry Reid keeps reminding us, is the longest vacation that Congress has taken in 6 decades. So when they went away, they had a second vote on this bill that would fund Zika, but to which Republicans decided to attach a measure to allow Confederate flags to fly in veteran cemeteries, a little measure that allowed any kind of pesticide spraying in any body of water anywhere, that essentially removed the EPA authority over the Clean Water Act for those kind of pesticide spraying. And they targeted Planned Parenthood so that Planned Parenthood couldn't give out contraception and advice to women who might fear becoming pregnant while these Zika mosquitoes were around. And they had to take one more whack at Obamacare and take some money away from that. So Democrats didn't want to vote for that in the middle of July before they went on vacations, after the Senate had already passed with 89 votes, if I remember correctly, a clean Zika bill, $1.1 billion, not as much as the White House wanted, by about $800 million. But still, it would have done the job. So politics intervened. It failed. So here we are back, right? Back hard at work in September after 7 weeks of rest. What did the Senate do? They brought up the very same Zika bill for the third time with all the riders, and they got exactly the same vote. And then they all said the same things. The Republicans said, look, the Democrats blocked the Zika bill again.
But the House has passed a clean bill.
No. It's the House that really messed it up.
Well, the Senate has a clean bill.
The Senate has a clean bill. They passed one originally.
And the House won't
touch
it.
Then the House took that bill, and remember the conference committees, how
right,
they
yes.
work out?
Yeah, yes, so, this is yes. how a bill becomes a law.
Right.
I have a hard time keeping track of who's passing clean and who's doing dirty. There ought to be a law against dirtying up bills with these kind of weird Christmas ornaments. At the same time, I think that probably the Planned Parenthood move, at the very least, could have probably been anticipated by Democrats. I mean, Planned Parenthood has actually been out on the front lines fighting Zika, advising women, trying to help them steer clear of the very real birth defects that could result if they get pregnant and become infected with Zika. Birth defects like hydrocephaly, which is it's a terrible thing for a child.
So you're saying Democrats should have anticipated that Republicans would not want Planned Parenthood to help women prevent Zika?
I mean, at this point, it can be anticipated. I don't know what you can do about it. The Confederate flag thing seems really ridiculous at this juncture.
Yeah, I don't even know where that one came from. Like, I couldn't figure out who on that conference committee was like, you know what? I'm going to plant that flag back in those cemeteries.
Right.
Yes,
that will definitely help things. Now, oh, there's a health crisis. We need more Confederate flags.
Yeah, well, maybe it'll scare the mosquitoes away, or maybe they'll only be southern mosquitoes.
I'd rather think that a Confederate flag would attract some kind of disease-carrying insect sense. Well, it has a history of attracting disease-carrying insects wherever it's unfurled. I can't believe we're back here at square one, and now it's going to be how long await until something new comes along? I mean,
they have to do something pretty quickly, right? Because the government runs out of money at the end of this month. The CDC,
oh, that's good news.
Well, shut down the CDC, right? The CDC literally has cobbled together, and the Department of the Health and Human Services Department has cobbled together all sorts of funds to keep the thing going. But those little, you know, scavenger runs through the couch. You know, that money goes away by the end of September, and they have to stop vaccine work. They have to stop, you know, spending money on diagnostics and all kinds of things that we really, really need to do to prevent Zika from becoming like it is in Puerto Rico, especially in places like Florida and Louisiana and places where there are lots of, you know, swampy standing water for the mosquitoes to breed in. So they got to do something. And there was a little glimmer of light yesterday when both Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell said they are talking with the White House to work this out along with the budget, which they always got to make it more complicated, so God
sure
knows what else they'll slide in there. But that should fund the government through December 9th. And then they can keep fighting about it after the election.
What adornments they put on this bill. So this week, there was a little stunt in the House as Representative David Jolly of Florida initially took to the floor looking like he had imprisoned the entire membership of the House Budget Committee in a jar. It turns out that those were mosquitoes in a jar.
A different kind of bloodsucker, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. See, you got the joke. That's good. What was he up to?
Well, you know, the funny thing about Congress and dealing with emergencies and diseases is that they don't seem to really give a crap until it affects them. Right. Remember Ebola? They were so scared. I mean, because Ebola makes you bleed and you die and it could happen to anyone. Right.
Yes.
They were yelling at the administration for like doing stuff and not doing enough. All right. Well, this they thought. But, you know, pregnant women, you know, we're old guys. We're not going to get Zika. So what? You know? All right. Well, so maybe it'll make you go blind, it turns out. Maybe you'll be paralyzed. Maybe you get dementia. All right. Well, they're starting to care a little bit more now, right? But they don't have the bugs in their state. So David Jolly went to, I don't remember the name of the research university in his district, and he got them to collect 100 mosquitoes in a jar, and he brought them there, and he said, I wonder what would happen if I loose these little suckers out in the floor of the house here. I bet you they'd be running to the physician to get tested. And he's probably right.
They should have done it. Like that woman who released all those crickets on the L train or whatever.
Well, I was wondering if he'd be charged with an act of bioterrorism or something like that.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
These mosquitoes weren't infected with Zika.
Not that we know of. Not that he knew of. He believed he had clean mosquitoes.
Clean mosquitoes,
you know? Right? And in hopes of getting a clean Zika bill.
That's a little bit of like an Aaron Brockovich moment in
right.
Congress. He should have just released them. That would have been awesome.
Right.
I mean, drag him to jail, I guess. But it would have been, I don't know, it would have been worth it. That kind of stunt kind of would have been worth it. So if you're out there listening, the best thing you can do is finagle a way to infect your lawmakers and their loved ones with the Zika virus. That's my literal joke advice to you right now, if you want anything to happen. Basically, really, if you want Congress to know anything, afflict them with your problem, and they you may have a chance of doing it. Otherwise, no.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
You know, that seems to be the way it works. It's just, you know, Congress doesn't really have a lot of empathy unless, like, they feel it themselves. So it's
right.
not really so much empathy as actual experience, I guess, that they respond to.
All right. Well, now that I've importuned our listeners to commit actual crimes, I think we should probably go.
Yeah, all right.
Mike, thanks for joining us to talk about this problem again. One day we're going to have you on to talk about something good and cool that Congress did.
That'll be a while.
Yeah, it'll be a while. Well, we'll come out of retirement to talk about it.
All right, that'd be cool.
All right, Mike McAuliffe, all thanks right. for joining us.
Right, thanks,
we will
Jason.
Be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we were joined by MTV News' Anna Marie Cox, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Mike McAuliffe, and Ryan Riley. So That Happened. It's available on your iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. We want to thank all of you for listening. We miss you already.